Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link with me, Assumpta Latus. Coming up, Burundian president is still under fire as protesters continue to demonstrate against his third term bid.
Many people are fearful. They are scared. They don't see until when this will last.
And as the world marks 70 years since the World War II came to an end, we hear from the forgotten African soldiers who fought on behalf of their colonial masters.
When we left, I thought I would never see my family again, and that my body would lie in the earth, far away from my homeland. We were told we would be fighting the Japanese, who were on the side of the Nazis.
Those stories and more coming up right after this.
Top story.
Tension is still running high in Burundi's capital Bujumbura as protesters continue to demonstrate against President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. At least four people were killed on Thursday in clashes between police and demonstrators. Protests started 2 weeks ago after the ruling party announced that it had nominated Nkurunziza as its presidential candidate. Thursday's death brings the number of people killed in the protests to at least 13 and 216 wounded. More than 30,000 Burundians have fled to neighbouring countries fearing political violence. Apollinaire Niyirora, a journalist in Bujumbura, is painting us a picture of the capital at the moment.
Many people are fearful. They are scared. They don't see until when this will last.
And what does the government actually say about the police brutality in handling demonstrators?
Well, the government says the police are defending themselves because they say the protesters are also brutal. Because they say if protesters barricade roads, they say this is not acceptable because they cannot block the activities of the city. They say this is unacceptable. And I would also tell you that protesters sometimes storm the policemen. That is why they fire tear gas, they use water cannons, and sometimes they also use live ammunition.
And what about the protesters? What do they say about the police brutality?
Yeah, the protesters say, well, police should let us continue our protest. But police have been blocking the protesters from reaching the city center because the target was the city center, a place called Independence Square. But so far, they haven't been able to reach the Independence Square.
We hear that many Burundians living in rural areas are Nkurunziza's sympathizers. What do they say about the current situation in their country?
Some of those people in the rural areas, especially in the provinces where Nkurunziza is very popular, those people are sympathetic and say Nkurunziza should have a green light to continue and run another term in office. So the people in the rural areas are sympathetic, apart from those living in towns, those who have been to school, who say, no, he has just completed his two terms, so he should leave the way to other candidates.
You are a journalist there in Bujumbura. Could you tell us what kind of challenges do you encounter?
Yes, there have been so many challenges that journalists are facing these days, especially when you go to cover an area where in a hostile area, if I could say like that, because I can give you an example of three reporters of a local radio called the Bonesha FM who went to a neighborhood called the Kanyosha, and then there were clashes between the ruling party youths called Imbonerakure and the protesters. So Imbonerakure wanted to remove the barricades, and then the protesters were putting again the barricades. Now, when the journalists went there, they were harassed, they were beaten. Well, they were beaten, they were ill-treated.
By whom?
It was by Imbonerakure youths. They were the one who harassed them, they who said, where are you going? Where are you coming from? Then they accuse them of having distributed arms to the other side, to the protesters.
I was speaking to Apollinaire Niyirora. Now, for an analytical view of what is happening in Burundi, I turned to Phil Clark, an expert in conflict and post-conflict issues in Africa at ZOAS in London.
I think it's a very worrying situation that the violence that we've seen in the last week or so seems to be escalating, and anything that the Burundian police or army are doing seems only to be exacerbating the situation. I think it's important to point out, too, that at this stage it doesn't seem to be violence that's motivated by ethnic considerations. It's quite a broad-based political opposition.
How different could the opposition be if it is going to be voted in?
The opposition in Burundi is extremely divided, and in fact most of the opposition parties boycotted the last election because they felt that Nkurunziza was rigging the vote. Most of the political parties in Burundi are made up of former rebel movements that have transformed themselves into parties. Almost none of those parties have ever had an opportunity to rule, and so they're a bit of an unknown quantity.
Some people say that Nkurunziza doesn't want to relinquish power just because of his leadership style and because of what he has done in the past while he was the president. Is this a fair statement?
I think Nkurunziza has several motivations for wanting to stay in power. I mean, one is that it's been a very lucrative period for him and his inner circle. He's enriched himself personally. Many of the senior members of his party have enriched themselves. There's a high degree of corruption in Burundian politics. So that's one motivation. The other motivation I'm sure that Nkurunziza has is that he would worry about what would happen to him personally if in fact he left power. That there would be the possibility of him being prosecuted for some of that corruption and other crimes that he's committed while he's been in power. He may fear some kind of revenge attack by elements within the military. I would imagine he's highly paranoid about this situation.
Well, some East African leaders visited Burundi on Wednesday, and they have planned a meeting or a summit to mediate the crisis. How do you see this playing out?
The concern in the region is that the crisis in Burundi has created a massive refugee flow into Tanzania, Rwanda and Congo in particular. The worry in those countries is that this could mean a huge humanitarian crisis in the next few weeks. Something like 40,000 refugees have left Burundi in the last couple of weeks. If those numbers were to escalate in the way that many people are predicting, then that's going to put a huge pressure on the neighboring countries. And so I'm not surprised that those states are talking about the crisis in Burundi. They're trying to find some sort of solution. But at this stage, we haven't actually seen a coordinated East African response to what's happening currently.
Phil Clark speaking from London. You're listening to Deutsche Welle's Africa Link with me, Assumpta Latus.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Now, May the 8th is a very important date in European history. It is the day on which 70 years ago, in 1945, Germany unconditionally surrendered and World War II came to an end. More than a million soldiers from Africa had fought on behalf of their colonial masters. They did not do so voluntarily, and most of them were badly treated and died on battlefields around the world. There was little, if any, compensation for those who survived, and their role barely gets a mention in history books. Teresa Krininger and Sale Mwanamilongo tracked down former African soldiers to hear their stories, and their report is now presented by Susan Holton.
Albert Kunyuku is 93 years old. He's the president of the Congolese Union of War Veterans, one of the last survivors of an expeditionary unit which fought under British and Belgian command in India and Burma. His enemy then was the Japanese army. Kunyuku did not think he would return home alive.
When we left, I thought I would never see my family again, and that my body would lie in the earth, far away from my homeland. We were told we would be fighting the Japanese, who were on the side of the Nazis.
Another war veteran, Babi C, a former French colonial soldier from the Republic of Upper Volta, now Burkina Faso, did not really know whom he was supposed to be fighting against.
People didn't understand the talk about fascism. Only the Europeans knew what was going on, but they only told us that the Germans had attacked us and considered Africans to be apes. As soldiers, we could prove to them that we were human beings. That was all the political explanation there was at the time.
From September the 3rd, 1939, when Great Britain and France entered into war with the German Empire, the Allies recruited around 500,000 soldiers and other workers in their colonies. African soldiers from the entire continent had to fight against German and Italian troops in North Africa and Europe, and later against the Japanese in Asia and the Pacific. European newscasts spoke of volunteers, but Congolese veteran Albert Kunyuku says this is not true.
We were forcibly recruited. I was working in a textile factory when I was picked up together with others. Then they went to other firms, such as Chanique, Ontara, Achevant. All the young workers were recruited. No one was older than 30.
There is still debate today as to whether African colonial soldiers were anything more than just cannon fodder. What is certain is that African soldiers came into close contact with Europeans and with the reality of life in Europe. For those who survived, this changed their perceptions of Europeans. Journalist Carl Russell, who spent 10 years researching the topic, says the war years had far-reaching consequences for the Africans.
The fact that the African soldiers saw for the first time their so-called rulers lying in the mud and filth, that they saw them suffering and dying, showed them that there was no difference between people. As a result, many later supported independence movements in their home countries.
Many war veterans are proud of their achievements. They were part of the successful battle to liberate Europe from fascism. But they are also bitter, because to this day they have received little or no recognition. Albert Kunyuku describes his experience.
Up to the end of the war, Belgium gave us nothing, and neither did our own government. We knew that the Belgians paid a sum of money to the Mobutu regime, but we have never seen any of it. We get a monthly pension of 5,000 CFA francs, that's about 5 euros. That is not fitting for someone who fought for Belgium's interests.
In 1946, Congolese soldier Albert Kunyuku returned home. He's one of the few survivors of 25,000 African soldiers whose first destination was India. In many other parts of the world, hundreds of thousands of young Africans lost their lives in a war that was not theirs.
A report by Teresa Krininger and Saleh Mwanamilongo.
Human rights.
In human rights this week, we go to Rwanda. When the genocide ripped the country apart in 1994, thousands of children were left orphaned. After the war, many of them lost their parents' properties when foster parents, relatives, and other guardians grabbed their land and assets. It has been a long battle for the orphans who demand to have what they claim rightfully belongs to them. Flora Kaitezi has more details.
22-year-old Nyirandayambaje Agnes is the only survivor in her family. All her relatives were killed during the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. This left her at the mercy of strangers or foster parents, including a woman who claimed to be her distant relative, whose ulterior motive was to grab Nyirandayambaje's inheritance. For 21 years, she lived in poverty and despair, but now she has become one out of more than 1,000 genocide orphans whose property was compensated. In the blink of an eye, this young woman became the owner of an 8-hectare piece of land located in western Rwanda.
I am relieved. What I will do now is endeavor to acquire health insurance, and perhaps I will rent out part of the land so that I can earn some money to sustain myself and buy some clothes because I have nothing to wear.
To many observers, Nyirandayambaje is lucky. Although her problem persisted for 21 years, it was solved after a businessman who expressed interest to buy the piece of land had misgivings about the alleged owner's credibility and alerted the authorities. According to Rwanda's Genocide Survivor Association, Ibuka, there are over 300 cases of orphans left behind by the genocide struggling to get what was bequeathed to them by their deceased parents. There is a backlog of cases in courts which worries survivors, as Ndayisaba William, the organization's coordinator in Rwanda's Rusizi district, explains.
This is a serious problem to us, having property that has not been returned to their owners. But the local authorities have been making slow progress in various ways. I think that the major issue is that the perpetrators have remained adamant, and this is because they have refused to accept that this is a problem caused by the genocide.
For these cases that remain unsolved, the major challenge, according to Ibuka, has been lack of evidence or information, as some orphans have no tangible evidence to prove that their parents owned the property they claim. Ndayisaba believes that mentalities need to change, especially at the local level, so that the property of survivors is returned to their rightful owners.
Local authorities must be careful not to believe the claims that people do not have the capacity to compensate what they confiscated. They should instead help them understand that even a gesture of acceptance or a show of goodwill that they are willing to return the property is a step in the right direction.
A new voice has now been added to the frustrations of the survivors, most of whom are in child-headed families. The National Human Rights Commission says that it's time to permanently put the predicaments of the survivors to an end. Madeline Nirere is the president of the Human Rights Commission.
To the people who grabbed the property of these survivors, the time has come for the rights of these children to be restored. It is time for them to have the right over their parents' property that legally belongs to them.
A legal advisor who declined to comment on the matter told me that given the pace of the cases which have made it to court, this problem is far from over. Rwanda's Senate has, however, urged the government to move fast to help genocide orphans recover their assets.
Flora Kaitesi reporting from Kigali. To South Africa now, the main opposition party there, the Democratic Alliance, or DA, will elect a new leader this weekend. This follows the surprise decision of the national leader Helen Zille to step down. Zille has been a leader of the DA for the past 8 years. Two main candidates, Musi Maimane and Wilmot James, are contesting the position. This report by Subri Govender starts by a clip of Helen Zille.
And very often people have asked me, how long will you stay as the leader of the Democratic Alliance? And I've always answered, I will know when the time is right. And believe me, I know that the time is right. And that is the reason that I will not be making myself available for re-election on the 9th of May.
When 64-year-old Ellen Ziller took over the leadership of the official opposition Democratic Alliance in 2007, the party was referred to as a two-person party, as it attracted only about 2% of the voters, and most of the DA voters at that time were white South Africans. But 8 years later, the DA has grown significantly through Ziller's leadership into a political party that has attracted more than 23% of the votes from both blacks and whites in the last general elections in 2014. The DA also controls the Western Cape province, the only region out of 9 provinces not governed by the ruling ANC. One of the two main leaders vying for Ziller's position is a young Turk, 35-year-old Musi Maimane, who has been the parliamentary leader of the DA since June 2014. Maimane has made his mark by speaking out against corruption and promoting South Africa as a country for all people, as he says.
The greatest challenge is that there are many political parties who are fighting for a better yesterday. Ours is to say, how do we build a better tomorrow? How do we ensure that South Africans know that they have an economy that is inclusive, have an education system that empowers them, that we ensure ultimately that we build a non-racial society? And the DA will champion that cause, because while others are trying to take us backwards, we want to take South Africa forwards, united behind a vision that says all of us can be key contributors to this nation.
Maimane firmly believes that South Africa will see a change in political governance within the next 10 years.
when a society becomes unstable, change is accelerated. The xenophobic attacks, high levels of unemployment indicate a South Africa that is facing some serious tension. And I think change is upon us. And I believe that South Africa will be a different place. And I think that time, whether 2019 or 2024, we will see a political realignment in South Africa. For certainly the model as we have it at the moment is not sustainable.
62-year-old Professor Wilmot James, a former anti-apartheid activist, is the other top official hoping to be elected as the new leader of the DA. A member of parliament and chairperson of the DA's federal council, James told me that he wants to lead the DA because he wants to stop the decline that South Africa is going through.
I have an understanding of the indignity of apartheid. I was part of the struggle against apartheid. I was part of the process that built a new constitution. I was part of the process of making sure that this democracy became stable, and it's faltered. It's failed South Africans, and I believe the DA is the only party left standing who can stem the tide of corruption, stem the tide of decline.
With only hours to go before the new leader is elected, it seems that the young Musi Maimane may have the edge on Wilmot James. He has received the open support of a number of top leaders within the DA, including the mayor of Cape Town, Patricia de Lille, a former struggle activist and Pan-Africanist. Political analysts and party members say whoever takes over from Zilla will have to work in a team if the DA hopes to become the governing party in a decade or so.
That was Subri Govinda reporting.
Your C.
Now, it's Friday, and after all these reports, it's time to hear what you, the listeners, have to say. Sela Onego has been going through our inbox. Hi, Sela.
Hi, Asumsha. Well, I think that we have to go once around the continent with this week's comments, so here goes. First to Uganda, where Charles Ngole and his DW Listeners Club commented on the boat disasters that have been happening off the North African coast in the Mediterranean.
Well, this is a topic that has been going around right now, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly.
Yeah. What does he say?
Well, he writes, or they write rather, what's appalling is the near predictable occurrence of these disasters in the face of African governments that seemingly are impotent in creating economic and social conditions that deter migration and keep their citizens at home. It's also troubling that Italy and the EU are unwilling or unable to help.
Interesting thoughts. So where do we go next?
We go to West Africa, where Aliyu Mohammed Al-Qassim from Yobe State in Nigeria commented on the recent rescue of the Boko Haram hostages from Sambisa Forest.
Wow, what does he say?
He writes that the recapture of the girls and women by the Nigerian army is indeed remarkable work, but he also asks, where are the Chibok schoolgirls?
Well, this is a question that everybody's asking.
Exactly. And he says it's for the Nigerian president, Jonathan. He says, Mr. President, you have just 21 days left to rescue our dear sisters. Redouble your efforts.
21 days is not a lot, I think. And we will have to see how Nigeria's next president, Buhari, deals with the situation, right?
Right. And now we have to jump to our next topic, which is also from Aliyu from Nigeria, who has some more thoughts on the situation in Burundi. He says that he hopes that in the upcoming elections, Burundians will follow the Nigerian example and have peaceful elections.
Mm-hmm.
And to add to this, Franz Ngogo from Tanzania also writes on Burundi. He says that as the court has given Nkurunziza the permission to run for presidency, all leaders of Africa should use their brains and respect what the masses want.
Wow, that's a very strong opinion. Thank you very much, Franz. And well, if you wish, you, the listener, wish to share your opinions with us, simply write an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or you can also send a text message to country code 491609575 9510, or a letter to Africa Link, DW53110, Bonn, Germany.
And now a summary of what we have been covering. At least four people were killed in Burundi on Thursday in clashes over the president's bid for a third term. And the official opposition party in South Africa, the Democratic Alliance, DA, is set to elect its new leader this weekend. And that's all we had time for. Join us again on Monday for another edition of Africa Link. Till then, I'm Assumpta Latus, wishing you a lovely weekend.